The Spectator magazine is home to wonderful writing, insightful analysis, and unrivaled books and arts reviews. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, along with a free £20 John Lewis or Waitrose voucher. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to the Edition podcast from The Spectator, where each week we shed a little light on the thought process behind putting the world's oldest weekly magazine to bed. I'm William Moore, The Spectator's features editor.
And I'm Laura Prendergast, The Spectator's executive editor. This week we look at the challenges facing the Chancellor ahead of her budget. Lord Moore and Lord Faulkner discuss whether assisted dying should be legalised, and we look at what queer life was like before homosexuality was legalised.
First up, Rupert Harrison, the former chief of staff to George Osborne, writes the cover piece for the magazine this week. In it, he argues that Rachel Reeves appears to be starting her tenure as Chancellor from a position of strength, but actually, she has played herself into a corner ahead of this month's budget, and her room for manoeuvre has been drastically limited by rash decisions that she's already made. So what will she do now, given that the early options have been ruled out? Well, Rupert joined me earlier to discuss, along with our economics editor, Kate Andrews. I started by asking Rupert to take us through the mistakes that the Chancellor has made so far.
Yeah, sure. Look, thank you for having me. I think that she, in many ways, starts from an incredibly strong position. She's obviously a very trained and experienced economist. She and Keir Starmer have a huge majority in the House of Commons. This is the first budget of an incoming administration with a huge majority. Should be the moment to set out the agenda for the next 5-10 years. But in order to get where she is, she and Keir Starmer have made some very early decisions that have really boxed her in, and particularly on tax, which I think is the big one, that they decided in the run-up to the election campaign and then very quickly under pressure during the election campaign to rule out raising any of the main taxes which generate most of the UK's tax revenue, so income tax, VAT, and crucially, national insurance. And they clearly felt the need to do this because they felt under pressure from the Conservative Party in the campaign. The problem is that when you look at any of the Labour Party's political ambitions for the next 5-10 years, what they see as their agenda, realistically, they require a huge amount of additional public spending. And so there's a lot of tough talk, for example, on the NHS about, you know, no money without extra reform. But actually, if they want to make any impact on waiting lists over the next 5 years, they've got to spend a lot of money on the NHS. You're talking about very large real terms increases in spending, similar to what we saw after 2000-2001 under the Blair-Brown government. And then you go across almost any area of government, and the same is true. And so that is a very, very difficult situation to be in, where you need to raise a huge amount of money and yet you have ruled out the biggest tax increases.
So if those big three have been ruled out, what's left to target?
So what they were hoping and what they came into government with was a lot of very optimistic numbers about essentially capital taxes, taxes on the wealthy, on international capital. So we're talking here capital gains tax in various forms, inheritance tax, and then other things like tax on non-doms, the sort of final closing of the non-dom loopholes that Jeremy Hunt had very deliberately left open when he tightened up the regime in government. And it's pretty clear that what has happened is that armed with numbers from pressure groups, left-wing think tanks saying you could raise $14 billion easily from capital gains tax, the number crunchers in the Treasury and crucially the OBR have looked at the evidence and said that just isn't true. And I remember back in 2010, when we came into government, the coalition government had a pledge as part of the coalition agreement with the Liberal Democrats to increase capital gains tax. We were told that the revenue maximising rate of capital gains tax was 28%. And so you try and raise it any higher than that, you're actually going to end up losing money because people will stop selling assets, they'll move abroad, and all of the avoidance options that are available to them. And I suspect the number has come down since then because there's, if anything, more mobility and more options than there was back in 2010. So on all of these options, they have suddenly been confronted with reality. This is something that happens to new parties when you come into power to begin with. All your sort of special schemes and think tank ruses get confronted with reality. And so the revenue they can easily raise from those capital taxes, I think, has come down a lot. And so they have returned back to employer national insurance with, now extraordinarily, they're very obviously not ruling it out. And Keir Starmer all but confirming that they are going to increase employer national insurance and claim, or at least try to claim, that this wasn't ruled out in the election campaign. And so it's a very uncomfortable position to be in.
Kate, on Rupert's point there about Labour being confronted with reality, Do you think that might explain some of the messaging we've been seeing ahead of this budget, which I think is fair to say is rather a doom and gloom sort of messaging? There's lots of talk of tough decisions. Sir Keir Starmer has warned that this budget is going to be painful. Is that because Labour have come into power and been confronted with a difficult reality?
I think there's been a bit of a roller coaster here. So I think a lot of the doomsday narrative that we started to get right when Labour entered number 10 and number 11 was meant to prepare the country for, yes, a somewhat painful budget, but I think the real deliberate effort there was to say, and this is actually the last Tory budget. We're going to try to clean up the mess of the Tories. There's that very vague 22 billion pound figure that Rachel Reeves continues to repeat, even though the Treasury won't actually tell us where many of those billions are attributed to. And I think that there was a deliberate effort to say, you know what, the Tories have left us in a mess, so we're going to have to clean it up. Then on the roller coaster, we went up for a bit because they realized it got way too negative. Consumer confidence was spiraling. They realized they'd gone too far. And going into party conference in September, the mood got a little bit cheerier. You know, this is a great time to be alive. The economy's going to be all right. We have some tough decisions to make, but give us a little bit of time and we'll get there. Now we're dipping on the roller coaster again, and I think that's for all the reasons that Rupert has highlighted, that actually the numbers are coming back from the Office for Budget Responsibility. Rachel Reeves's tax hikes look like they might raise a couple hundred million, not the billions they were expecting. In some cases, they might actually lose revenue. And there is an irony here that the OBR and, of course, Liz Truss's mini-budget were talked up throughout the election by the Labour Party to remind the public what happened when those 49 days occurred. Labour wed itself to the OBR. It basically became gospel. And it wasn't like that when George Osborne set up the OBR, was it, Rupert? The idea was, yes, you're going to have accountability here, but David Cameron and George Osborne were actually able a bit more to push back on labour reforms, for example, and say, look, the OBR says our labour reforms won't account for much. We think, actually, it will get more money into the Treasury, and it did. We're now in a completely different time where Rachel Reeves, and Keir Starmer for election reasons, made the OBR into gospel. And now when the OBR writes back and says, actually, we're really not convinced that's going to raise revenue, they can't challenge it in the same way that perhaps they once could. Maybe they shouldn't challenge it. I mean, given the fact that the country is taxing and spending at record levels, perhaps you really can't bleed the stone much more. But they've really tied their hands here, I think, in multiple ways, not just on the taxes they've ruled out, but on their commitment to the OBR that is more extreme than it ever has been before.
I would love your thoughts, Rupert, on that. Is it a case of a government lives by the OBR, it dies by the OBR?
Look, I think there's a little bit of that. They clearly have elevated it and sort of made a lot of that after the Liz Truss episode. But I think the real issue is that the OBR is not a political organisation and the Treasury is not a political organisation. They genuinely depend on evidence. And you are able to influence the OBR if you bring evidence. So, for example, in 2012, we cut the top rate of tax from 50% to 45%. Now, the static costing of that was more than £2 or 3 billion. We and HMRC produced the international evidence saying that actually what are known as the elasticities of very high tax rates are much lower because there's so much avoidance activity, people leave the country, etc., that we ended up with a costing that if you cut it from 50 to 45, that would only cost £100 million, so a fraction of the static costing. The OBR was happy to sign that off because we presented evidence. The problem Labour have right now is that they came in with this sort of bogus evidence from a bunch of left-wing think tanks. But the evidence, the hard evidence on taxation of capital, like capital gains tax, is that there isn't much to be raised precisely because it's so hard to do in a globalised economy. So, you know, the way the OBR is set up is absolutely the politicians have the last word. You can always say, I disagree, I'm going to do this anyway, we respectfully disagree. Or you could present evidence to the OBR and get them to change their mind. It's perfectly possible. But Labour aren't able or willing to do either of those things. So, I mean, I think it's quite an interesting point to make too, though, you know, there have been some kind of conservative critics of the OBR, particularly, you know, the sort of Liz Truss group around her were very critical. I think it's very interesting to note that the OBR has been equally effective at skewering kind of wishful thinking from the left, just as it was able to skewer wishful thinking from the right. This is not a political organisation. It's just an organisation where evidence is king. And if you haven't got the evidence and you're relying on wishful thinking, you're going to come a cropper.
Speaking of evidence or lack thereof, this 22 billion black hole that Rachel Reeves loves to talk about, Is there any evidence for this?
No, not really. I mean, I think that this is, you know, where we were hearing about the doom and gloom, I totally agree. I think some of that was very deliberate theatre to deal with a very significant problem, which is they don't have a mandate for higher taxes. So they need to raise taxes to achieve their political ambitions. They went out of their way to say they wouldn't in the election campaign. So no mandate. Again, big contrast with 2010, where the Conservatives had spent over a year before the election saying we are going to have to cut spending and giving very, very painful examples of how that would happen. So there clearly was a mandate then for the coalition government to go ahead and do that. Labour have tried with this $22 billion to create a mandate out of nothing in the matter of a couple of months, and it hasn't really worked. The reason is that the substance is very questionable. The Treasury won't publish the underlying assumptions. The biggest part of it was the public sector pay awards that were a Labour decision. And then even the, you know, overspending on the asylum system, which clearly is a real part of overspending. That's something that is managed every single year within government through something called the reserve. There are some departments that have overspends, other departments have underspends. And at the end of the year, the Treasury sort of groups it all together and fixes it. By picking earlier in the year just the overspend and saying it was part of a black hole, that is real smoke and mirrors. I mean, this is just the normal process of government. Mm. And so that's why I think this $22 billion has not landed. I think, you know, in Westminster, there is a huge amount of scepticism that this is very obviously theatre designed to try and justify tax rises that they weren't willing to campaign on in the election.
It's also worth saying that while the Treasury won't publish the details of what the Reserve Fund has supposedly been spent on in the first 3-4 months of the fiscal year, in theory, the only information they have given out is that it's based on spending assumptions. It's not based on money actually spent. If you speak to Tories who were previously in the Treasury, they will say to you, look, our job was when departments came and said, we need an extra billion here or there, our job was to say no. The idea that just because a request is put in that you get the money out is simply not the case.
So absolutely.
It's smoke and mirrors, you know, to the extreme.
Kate, Rupert ends his piece by saying that there is a chance that the general economic cycle could actually save Labour in some ways through factors that are actually beyond the government's control, namely lower interest rates. That seems like something that could be happening. We also had good news economically recently that inflation has dropped again, which, as a side note, makes the early election call for by Rishi Sunak seems even more of an odd decision. But there we are. So are there these factors outside the government's control that you think could still mean that Reeves could pull off some of her ambitions?
Yes, there are. And there are reasons to be optimistic. The way that the UK growth figures have been revised upwards over and over again this year, we're still not talking about anything to write home about. It's not terribly impressive, say 1.1 or 1.4% growth. But at the start of the year, people thought the UK was going to look really quite bad compared to other advanced economies. And now the OECD, most recently, their forecast suggests that the UK will be tied for the second highest growing economy in the G7. So there are reasons to be optimistic, and interest rates is another one. When Liz Truss tried to implement her mini budget, she was dealing with interest rates going up worldwide. Makes a lot of people at the time, and certainly since, question as to why they were asking the markets for about £100 billion worth of borrowing and spending for energy price controls at that time. Rachel Reeves, when she's going to try to borrow more, and all the signs are that she is going to loosen the fiscal rules further, she's doing it in a very different environment. Interest rates are coming down in a slow and steady way. More good news on inflation. It's actually fallen slightly under the Bank of England's target. We shouldn't expect it to stay there, but if it does rise slightly, we're not talking anything like the inflation crisis that we just saw for the past couple of years. And the Bank of England has been very clear in its minutes that for months now that they think the monetary policy has been tight enough, that there is scope to keep lowering interest rates, even if inflation ticks up slightly. But Rachel Reeves is not going to benefit from ultra low interest rates. In fact, no government probably for a very long time is going to benefit from that again. And we've seen the horrors that have come out of keeping rates so artificially low. So when she spends a pound, she still has to account for it. And borrowing costs are incredibly high. Last year, they cost the UK roughly twice its defense budget. You don't get anything new for that money. You don't get new planes. You don't get new nurses or doctors. You're paying off money you've already spent. Those debt servicing payments are incredibly painful at the moment. So, you know, we don't want to overstate the good news for Rachel Reeves. But I think what we might be able to say is that in a year's time, her next budget could indeed look a little bit easier, especially if by that time rates have come down from, say, 5% to 3.5%, even slightly higher than that, you'd be in a new world and she would have more scope. But this parliament was always going to be a hospital pass. Right. One of the benefits of the OBR is that we knew for a long time leading up to this election and to this budget that there was about 20, 25 billion pounds worth of spending that had not been allocated for public services. And Labour was always going to have to find that. It was always going to be a really big challenge.
My final question to you, Rupert, is if you may indulge me, I'd like to imagine that you're advising Rachel Reeves. What advice would you be giving her of how to balance the budget without breaking some of Labour's big manifesto promises? Is it just a case that some political ambitions are going to have to be scaled back?
I think that it's actually the promises that are going to have to go, because I think they've got themselves in such a difficult situation. If I'm advising Rachel Reeves now, you've got to take the political ambitions as they are, which is significant injection of money into a broad range of public services. I think that is going to be the test at which Labour are tested at the next election, particularly the NHS. If they have not delivered a material reduction in waiting times and a kind of obvious improvement in the NHS at the next election, I think the voters will say, well, what are you for? And so I would say take the hit now. I think there is a good rule generally that you're better off defending one big unpopular tax rises than lots of little tax rises that unravel and cause you problems.
And just make the system so much more complicated.
I don't think it's a good tax rise and I wouldn't be doing the big increase in spending. But if you do need the big increase in spending, I think just go all in on employer national insurance, have one big row, take the hit up front and hope that in 3 or 4 years' time, everyone's forgotten the row about the broken promise and they're more focused on the fact that all that spending you put into public services is bringing down, you hope, waiting lists and having an impact. Which comes back to the point we're just talking about. Look, it's a long game. This has been an incredibly weak, a disastrous start to a new government, probably the most disastrous in living memory. She's got a huge problem in this budget because the way she's boxed herself in. But it's a long game. A lot can happen. And they've got to get money flowing to their priorities and demonstrate some progress over the next 4 years. Otherwise, they're absolutely done for.
Rupert and Kate, thank you both very much for joining me. Laura, what else did you enjoy from the magazine this week?
I'm going to go for an arts piece and a TV piece this week, Will. The arts piece is actually in the book section. It's Charlotte Hobson reviewing Martin Gayford, How Painting Happens and Why It Matters. Charlotte says this book is perfect for anyone who revels in the deliciousness of oil painting. And there's one quite irresistible detail where she points out that it was actually Rembrandt who developed a method of emulsifying egg, oil and pigment into globules that held their shape. So she says that actually 100 years before the Duc de Richelieu's chef, Rembrandt, in fact, invented mayonnaise. So I enjoyed that review a lot. The other piece is James Walton's review of Industry, the TV show about finance, which is on the BBC at the moment. I'm perhaps a little biased here because the show was written by two great friends of mine, Mickey Down and Comrade K. But I think it is a very exceptional TV programme. It's certainly quite stressful at times to watch. And James Walton says it's both horrifying and titillating, which I think is a very good assessment of it. And listeners might also be interested to know that The Spectator features in the show. We helped put together an original cover, complete with a Morton image, and a cover piece supposedly written by our political editor, Katie Balls. So anyone watching the show might spot that. I think it appears around the 6th or 7th episode. Will, what about you?
Well, we're going to hear a little bit from Philip Hensher later in this podcast, talking about the book's lead for this week. However, I would like to actually draw our attention to another piece that is written in this week's magazine, which is the guest life column, Park Life, in which he writes about being fat shamed by the local heroin addict, which is written with Philip's typical wit and flair. So I recommend that to our listeners.
Next up, as Kim Leadbeater's private member's bill comes before the Commons on assisted dying, we ask the former Justice Secretary, Lord Faulkner, who introduced a similar bill to the Lords, and the Spectator's chairman, Lord Moore, to debate the ethics of assisted dying. You can watch the entire debate on Spectator TV, but here is an extract from their discussion.
There was a huge passage there. First, you appear to be saying that people should not have a choice when they are terminally ill as to how and when they die. I recognise the need for safeguards in relation to that, but I do not think that is an inherently bad thing. And indeed, the underlying principle of the terminal illness bills that I have introduced is that it is, in principle, subject to safeguards, inherently a good thing that you should have a degree of autonomy about how you die. I see no inherent goodness in having to suffer if you're dying anyway, and that's not what you want. The second point you made, I think, was that if people are given that choice is subject to exploitation and abuse by others. Completely separately from my bill, when one is ill, there are a lot of choices that have to be made about whether or not, for example, medical treatment is going to continue.
Indeed, yeah.
For very many of those choices, they're not the choice of the patient at all. Mm. They are made by their doctors, hopefully with consultation, but sometimes not. Mm. There are a range of choices that people have when they are dying. For example, should I take a particular treatment that might extend my life by a month or two or a year? Those choices are presumably equally exploitable in your book, but have absolutely no safeguards whatsoever. It seems to me that on the basis, and I'm only talking about my bill, I'm not talking about the bill that will come in the Commons, though I suspect it might be quite similar. The idea that you are, before you are going to be given an assisted death when you're terminally ill, the fact that you there has to be your treating doctor, an independent doctor, and a judge to check that you are not being exploited is a pretty strong safeguard. It will make this particular decision the strongest and most safeguarded thing in, I'd have thought, the treatment of terminally ill people. And just the third point that you made, which is people reach, and this is not your language, but people reach what might not be their real view because they're tired, they're ill, they're depressed, they're the whole range of things. True, but again, those people who have had experience of dealing with those who are terminally ill will tell you that it's often very clear what people want, what that people do not anymore want to go on for the next few days or the next few weeks in what they are suffering. And there's really no doubt that that's their position. And the safeguards in my bills, and I suspect in Kim Leadbitter's bill as well, will reflect that. So I'm really interested in your, and this is the wrong language, but your very austere view that people should not have choice in this matter.
No, it's not austere. It's trying to remember that we live in a culture and we live in a society and we're not in that sense autonomous. We are, of course, we have freedom, quite rightly so, and so we are free to kill ourselves, among other things. But what's at stake here is not just what one person feels. It's how the whole of society is constructed and how it's constructed in the most humane way possible. And I just want to pursue the point about what happens to professionals in this for a moment.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. You put it really strongly there when you said this bill is about the whole of our society is constructed. You put it like that in relation to the bill, whilst at the same time accepting the way that society now treats this position as being perfectly okay. Because, again, you correct me if I'm wrong, Charles, but you're saying I'm not averse to the idea that if you help somebody you love to die, assume you're not a medical professional, you're content for there to be no criminal justice consequences for that.
In most cases, I mean, obviously we're not talking about bad motives here, but in good motives, I think it would be self-defeating for there to be criminal justice consequences. But I think there should be a massive inhibition against pursuing this course of action. And if I take up what happens with professionals...
Is this a moral or is this a practical policy thing?
Both.
In the sense that...
Both. It's very much a practical policy thing as well as a moral thing, because it's a question of what happens next.
Mm.
And what happens next in a society which goes this way, and I admit this is not so specific to your particular point about terminal illness, though I can come to that because I think there are significant problems there, is that then policy starts to change. So, for example, in a National Health Service, which is, you know, notoriously desperate for money despite getting more and more all the time, and it can't do all its work and so on. It will be cheaper and in some sense easier for there to be more assisted suicide. And in some societies, people will say this sort of thing quite openly. And in more unpleasant societies, they will extend that to, well, I think it's very unpleasant to extend it to the old, but even more, they extend it to the handicapped and so on. Because people have a sort of idea, it's a totalitarian idea, where they have a sort of moral hygiene, social hygiene, when you say, what's the point of somebody who's not productive? So that they're mentally handicapped, they're autistic, they're terribly ill, disabled. And you do not want to open the door to that way of looking at things. And also, and I'm sure you don't want to open that door, by the way, but I still think it's there. Also, you don't have to open that door. I think one thing that's... I was very distressed by Kim Ledbetter saying that if we don't get her bill, the choice would be suffering, suicide or Switzerland. No, that's not the case.
It's
very insulting to hospice movement and palliative care to say that. We should be doing more for the hospice movement and palliative care. And it's insulting to a lot of people who look after those they love, non-professionals and carers and so on in these situations. Not all pain can be relieved, not all suffering can be relieved, but nevertheless, there's a more optimistic way in looking at our society today, which is we're actually better at all of this than we used to be. And we take more trouble. We would have thought, you know, when you and I were, I suppose we're roughly the same age, when you and I were young, there was much more of an assumption, for example, that nothing much could be done about disability. And that children, which were in those days, they were called Mongols, which showed how people thought, are now called Down syndrome, you know, had to be more or less locked away and it couldn't be integrated into society and so on. And actually, we got much better at that type of thing. And I think similarly, we have the capacity, we don't always fulfil that capacity, but we do have the collective capacity to make dying, to assist dying, in fact, in a real sense. And it's more of a problem in one way because there are more old people. But in another way, it's not a problem that we can't address. We do address it, and we are improving. And it's much less horrible in many ways than it used to be. So I feel there's a sort of inner pessimism in the other side of the argument, which I'm resisting.
No, I think you're completely wrong about what you're saying in two big respects. Mm. The first proposition, which is the one that if you allow assisted dying in the context of terminal illness, you're opening the door to people's lives more generally being treated as not worthwhile. For example, if they are severely disabled, or for example, if they are old. Absolutely not. There is, for many people who are severely disabled, a constant fear not to do with dying, but to do with an approach that the medical profession takes. Mm. When they see people who are severely disabled, oh, your life is so compromised, do you want to be helped to go on living? Mm. And they're worried about that the whole time. And I completely sympathise with that. Mm. The proposal that's being made in the terminal illness assisted dying bills is the reverse of that, because in all circumstances, there are proper safeguards. There is no real risk there that people will say their views or their wishes to continue to live will be overridden. The problem that you identify is a problem much more outside the context of terminal illness, but in the context of the views that society take generally. So I completely reject that suggestion that if you introduce a heavily safeguarded assisted dying provision, that is going to lead to people saying, oh, people who are, for example, disabled should just be not treated. And just to look at the evidence in relation to that, go to the states in America, which have been doing this for longest. There is absolutely no evidence whatsoever of that at all. And so I completely repudiate the idea either that there's evidence for it or that opening the door in this way will lead to this horrible dystopian picture that you create. And then your second point, I'm sorry to go on a bit. And your second point is, well, we've got better in palliative care, and we most certainly have. And that's an extremely good thing. And my proposition to allow this is not an either or. I'm very strongly in favour of allowing or encouraging as much investment in palliative care as possible. And you'll have read the Select Committee report, which suggests that there's evidence that where you introduce an assisted dying bill of the sort that I'm proposing, that leads to people focusing much more on terminal illness. And it leads, as a result, to there being increases in the amount of money that is spent on palliative care. But everybody engaged in this debate, and I take by way of one example, Elora Finlay, who is a very respected palliative care doctor. She acknowledges that no matter how good palliative care can be in any individual case, there will always be people who nevertheless want to take their own lives in the context of terminal illness. And you can see it from one's own experience. So I'm not suggesting for one moment that we shouldn't improve palliative care, but I am saying the suffering of certain people when they are dying should be alleviated by this.
You're very right to pay tribute to Elora Finlay, but I should put it on the record that she will certainly not be agreeing with what you're saying.
Well, she will be agreeing with me. She's agreed it already in evidence to the effect that there will be certain people, no matter how good the palliative care is, will still want to take their own lives. I completely agree with you.
As a matter of fact, true.
Yes. She will disagree with me in relation to whether or not my bill should go through.
Yes. Can I, because you focus, and quite justifiably, because that's what it says, on terminal illness, I want to say a little bit about that. It's terminal illness and it's 6 months.
In my bill, yes.
And I think there are serious questions about that, both the terminal illness and the 6 months. It's actually not often tremendously easy to diagnose terminal illness. And it's particularly difficult to diagnose it within a time frame of 6 months. And one thing that's very noticeable, now again, it's an age question, lots of my friends have cancer, and lots of them have so-called terminal cancer, but lots of them live for years with terminal cancer. And this is to do with the great improvement of drugs, where you know before you start the course that they're not going to cure you, but they're going to significantly extend your life. And so all that seems to me to be those basically good things that's happening. And it makes it much, much harder to judge whether this 6 months actually will mean anything. And I think the fact that those changes are taking place also is likely to affect the people who would, in your view, benefit from your bill. Because you actually very often don't know what's going to happen. And the doctors don't know, and the medical profession doesn't necessarily know, and the pharmaceutical developments and scientific discoveries and so on. So you have an odd situation in which, if your bill is passed, or Kim Leadbitter's bill, in which people actually want a terminal diagnosis because they've decided, in my view, unfortunately, that this would then allow them to have assisted suicide. We're in quite murky territory here, aren't we?
And finally, in the book section this week, Philip Hentscher reviews Peter Parker's Some Men in London, Volume 1, Queer Life 1945 to 1959, and Volume 2, Queer Life 1960 to 1967. Philip joined us earlier, alongside Peter, to discuss how attitudes towards homosexuality have shifted in the post-war period. Philip, in the magazine this week, you review Peter's new volumes on queer life, and you declare that the ludicrous attitude towards homosexuals in post-war Britain may seem hilarious to us now, but it wasn't so funny at the time. Could you start by perhaps painting a brief portrait of that period for listeners who perhaps might not be so familiar with it?
Well, it was illegal. Homosexual acts between men were illegal. Between women, they never were illegal. So I'm pleased that Peter has focused on this particular community. But there was increasing, I think, pressure to liberalise what was obviously a very absurd situation, increasingly absurd situation. And a report, the Wolfenden report in 1957, recommended decriminalising it, and took another 10 years of various resistance. And of course, as in all these liberalisation measures, it was accompanied by various crackdowns by the authorities. and all sorts of very difficult situations that that arose, and of course still did go on arising after the legalisation in 1967. But Peter's the expert.
Well, Peter, so on this point, the two volumes which you've written, the split between 1945 to 59 and then 1960 to 67, I wondered, can you explain to our listeners why you settled on those dates, but both overall and in terms of when you divided them down the middle?
Well, overall, it was originally one volume. And overall, we decided to start in 1945 because the Second World War was coming to an end. And there was a great moral panic arising because it was felt that men had been away at the war. Therefore, women had been left to look after children and making a bad job of it because, you know, you do need the firm paternal hand. So there was a rise in juvenile delinquency, there was a rise in pregnancy, and there was a perceived rise in homosexuality. So we were also at that point losing the empire or beginning to lose the empire. So there was this feeling that Britain was going to the dogs, and we always looked for scapegoats, and homosexuals became one of the scapegoats. What I wanted to do was to trace from that period of moral panic through to the point where homosexuality, as Philip said, was partially decriminalised. So there was a trajectory throughout the book, and one was working towards this slightly brighter moment. Though, of course, like any steps towards liberalisation, it was sort of three steps forward and two steps back. And we split it where we did. I mean, it was just good fortune. I'd amassed so much material that we cut and we cut and we cut. And then my editor said, look, if we cut anymore, we're just going to wreck it. So let's do two volumes. And it just seems sensible to hive off the 1960s, which we all think of this great era of liberalisation, which, of course, it was for a lot of people, and London was swinging, and it was a different atmosphere to the 40s and 50s. But on the other hand, homosexuality was still illegal. So for gay men, London didn't swing perhaps as much as people thought it would.
And how did you go about amassing that material? Because Philip makes the point in his review that there weren't huge amounts of text necessarily kept, and he says a comparison might be drawn to the textual means historians have of understanding another prescribed culture, the early Christians in Rome. So what was your
yes,
approach?
Yes, I mean, it is tricky. For example, I have got diaries and letters, but because police could raid your house, if your neighbour, for example, said, well, this chap seems to be having a lot of young men coming through his house, I think the police should investigate. They could raid your house and they would steal letters and diaries, not steal, sorry, they would appropriate letters and diaries to be used in evidence. And of course, that could incriminate other people. So a lot of people who would have been keeping a record burned them or destroyed them, or families later destroyed them after they died, or friends got in before families could in order to keep the secret. So finding that sort of material was quite difficult. I mean, Chips Channon, the MP, actually kept his diaries in a vault in the Bank of England. He went and deposited them and then took them out again to look at them. So finding those sort of things are quite difficult. I knew the period fairly well, so my own library was full of books on the subject and novels and biographies and so on. And so there were various archives that I went to. So the LSE has the Hall Carpenter Library, which is a collection related to homosexuality and specifically to Homosexual Law Reform Society, which was formed in order to persuade the government to act on the Wolfenden recommendations. And then there were various, the National Archives have a lot of the Wolfenden material. Then you have the British Board of Film Censors, or film classification as it now is, and the British Library has the Lord Chamberlain's papers about censoring the theatre. But also there's the Bishopsgate Institute, which has probably the largest collection of LGBTQ plus material. But specifically, they have something called the Lesbian and Gay Newspaper Archive, where someone has Xeroxed a lot of stories out of newspapers over many, many years. It's not comprehensive. And of course, a lot of it refers to material relating to outside London, and I'm restricted to London, but at least it focused my searches.
Philip, as you say in your review, and also as Lara mentioned earlier in this podcast, you know, some of the accounts given in Peter's books are actually quite amusing in terms of how ridiculous they are in terms of the types of things that are being said about homosexual men at the time, even though it wasn't amusing at the time. But I wondered, I'd love to get your opinion on how the nature of homophobia has changed. I mean, within even your own lifetime, what have you noticed in terms of the sorts of comments that are made either in the media or even among friends? Or, I mean, how has bad reaction changed in that sense?
I think there's a sort of awareness when people are being homophobic, which I suppose is a step forward. I mean, once or twice, I've been subjected to a bit of homophobic abuse by a passing stranger. And it's quite surprising that after 5 minutes of them saying something like, "Look at you big puff," and I would say, "Yes, I'm a big puff, so what?" Then they always say, "Yes, and you should be proud of it." I was like, "What?" So there's that kind of awareness that's creeping up. I think that genuinely a lot of the things in Peter's book, and I think I should really emphasise that, I mean, it's not a story of victimhood. It's full of wonderfully inspiring stories of people kind of, working out a way to live their lives as they chose. And it's also extremely funny. But I think that a lot of the people, the voices, the anti-homosexual voices in Peter's anthology that strike us as being grossly homophobic, they probably wouldn't have thought of themselves as being homophobic. They would have thought of themselves as dealing with a social nuisance or addressing something that the people involved could do something about if only they'd chosen to. And that's changed. I mean, we can, if you like, get on to the subject of where a lot of gay men and lesbians of my generation think that homophobia is coming from now, which is, people taking a strong line on gay men that don't take a supportive view towards trans activism. But I think that's probably a subject for another day.
Maybe leave that for a separate one. And Peter, what are some of your favourite anecdotes from the book? Perhaps the more uplifting ones that Peter... more interesting ones that Philip refers to.
Well, one of the nice things that has happened is that a lot of particularly younger people have said, I had absolutely no idea that there were gay bars and gay clubs in the 1940s and 50s. I assumed these were something from the later period. And so it's rather nice that... And they also said, "I never knew that gay men had such fun and I had so much sex," as though, it's rather like we always used to think the Victorians never actually had sex. And of course they were at it like rabbits the whole time, including the gay ones. But I think there are wonderful stories about people who... if they go to a club and it's raided, the unlucky ones are arrested, but unless they were actually caught in some sort of act, they probably got off. And then they just move to another bar. So they're always one step ahead of the police. And there's just a sort of feeling of people just getting on with stuff and fighting back. I mean, there's a book called... it comes at the end, is it called Queer People, by someone called Douglas Plummer, not his real name, and it was published in the 60s. And the first chapter is, "I am not ashamed." And it says, I'm a queer, I'm a pansy, so are a lot of the people I fought in the Second World War with, And it does that thing of saying, we are like you. But at the same time, it also says, actually, what other minority would stand up to or put up with what was being said in the newspapers? And he said, I think homosexuals need to sort of actually stand up to this and complain and not just take it lying down, as it were.
Well, slightly related to that point, Peter, I would love to get your view on who you think, in when doing all of your research for these books, who really jumped out for you as some of the champions of liberalisation, whether that's in terms of the law or in terms of politics or even in terms of a shift in the culture. Who are some of the figures that you would really like to highlight?
Well, I think one of the key figures, and important because he's more or less forgotten, is A.E. Dyson, who was an academic, and he's the person that founded the Homosexual Law Reform Society. And the Homosexual Law Reform Society, as I said, was intended to persuade... I mean, government didn't even get round to debating the Wolfenden recommendations till over a year after the report was published. And there was a lot of foot-dragging, so there were a lot of politicians sort of saying, "Well, we understand this sort of thing, but our constituents, the working classes won't understand it." And of course, this is complete nonsense, but they hid behind this. So A. Dyson and a married clergyman called A. Halliday Smith, they got together and formed this society. And in my day, you know, we went on gay liberation marches and marched through the streets. In those days, you wrote letters to the Times and you got the great and the good to sign them. And it's a completely different world. And I think that people like Dyson, his name has more or less been forgotten. And he was a real champion and he went on. And then Anthony Gray, who was the secretary and ran the Albany Trust, which was founded against the psychiatric community, where they found psychiatrists who would actually help gay men and lesbians adjust to their lives rather than be cured. Mm. And as I say in the introduction, some of these cures that were put about were absolutely as crude as showing naked men to someone who you dose with emetics so they would vomit, or you dose them up with LSD or double brandies. I mean, it was really, really crude stuff. Mm. So I think people like that ought to be remembered. And then, of course, at the other end, there are people like Kenneth Williams and Joe Orton. And, I mean, Joe Orton's an example. Quite a few of the people whose diaries I quote, although they write quite explicitly about their sex lives, they're not terribly happy homosexuals, as we say. I mean, Keith Vaughan, wonderful painter, brilliant diarist, but his diaries, although beautifully written and so observant, are fairly dispiriting reading often. Mm. The same with James Courage, the New Zealand novelist whose diaries I have, whereas Joe Orton just clearly didn't give a damn. And that's, I think, what everybody says, oh, Joe Orton, it's so extraordinary. He wrote in all this detail about exactly what he did in public lavatories. But actually, what's more interesting is that he did it without any sense of shame at all. And that's very refreshing. And then Kenneth Williams, who did feel bad about being gay, but also created on Round the Horn the Julian and Sandy sketches, which introduced Polari, the gay language, to Radio 4's audience, or the fourth programme as it was. And a lot of these jokes went over people's heads. But here were two gay men. And in fact, both, although the Julian Sandy sketches were written by two heterosexuals, they were played by two gay men. And you can hear, listening to them, how much is ad-libbed, including quite a lot of corpsing going on. And, you know, they just burst into the living rooms of the middle classes and all classes with these jokes, and people laughed. And sometimes you thought they couldn't have quite got the nuances that were put in there, whereas the gay audiences were saying, oh, yes, oh, yes. I mean, one of my favourites, because they were very good on double entendre, was where they, which is in the book, there's a sketch about them writing a musical together. And then Kenneth Orton says, oh, well, perhaps you'd like to show us what you're up to. And he said, oh, yes, Jules is a dab hand at the cottage upright, which, of course, is a piano, but also a cottage upright and a dab hand suggests other things. You know, and it was full of that stuff.
There's a glorious moment of pure Julian and Sandy emerging in real life when one of the pretty policemen who is sent down to the public lavatories in order to tempt cottagers with his good looks turns out to be called PC Butcher. Yes. So he couldn't make it up.
Well, the two policemen who were interviewed by the Wolfenden Committee, the good thing about that is that sometimes people wrote submissions that they sent into the Wolfenden Committee, but at other times they actually called in people to interview. So a stenographer took down what they said, so it is entirely in their unmediated language. And actually, I think those two coppers come out of it rather well. I mean, they're doing a job, but they're quite funny about it.
They are, but they also make it quite plain what the Met always denied,
yes,
which is that they kind of encouraged, yes, the approaches.
Yes,
the one of them says, "Well, I said to my mate, if he'll follow me into the toilet, then he'll follow me all the way to the police station," and he did.
Yes, whereupon this poor man was arrested. But he sort of felt quite sorry for this man who had sort of followed him all the way. But I don't suppose it stopped him carrying on doing the job.
I reckon those policemen sometimes, they said, right, I'm knocking off now, let's get at it.
Peter, just finally, the name Wolfenden obviously occurs a lot through your book. Funny enough, it's a name I remember from my childhood, because Wolfenden was a master at Uppingham and my grandfather
was
there, and he used to speak very favourably of him and said he was a wonderful man. And could you just talk a bit about him? Because his involvement obviously is so key.
Yes, well, Wolfenden was appointed by the government to head this committee looking into homosexuality and prostitution. I think it probably says quite a lot about views at the time that these two were bracketed together. And the police often didn't differentiate between women or indeed men on the game and people who were just looking for friendship or sex. You know, they were all treated as though they were the same, given cautions or not, or arrested. But Wolfenden, he was a bit of an old stick, but he you know, he'd been, I think at the time he was Chancellor of the University at Reading, but as you say, he'd been headmaster of two public schools. I think Shrewsbury was the other one. So he must have had a fair idea. He also had a gay son, Jeremy Wolfenden, this rather shadowy figure who was mixed up in espionage later in his life. And Jeremy claimed that when his father was appointed, he wrote him a letter saying, perhaps we should see rather less of each other and could you wear rather less eye makeup? I suspect that's made up. I think that might be Jeremy Wolfenden making it up. But Wolfenden, he was very much one of those... I mean, all the people on the Wolfenden Committee, they were sort of there as representatives of society. And, you know, we're thinking people, we're not prejudiced. And of course they were to some extent. And I think Wolfenden could be quite naive when he said, when appointed, he said in public, in a queer sort of way, I'm looking forward to it. You know? And of course, we all roar with laughter now. And then when they did pass the law, he did make this little speech to say, this is not to say we condone homosexuality. And the point he was making was that we don't condone it, but we don't see why homosexuality should be singled out from, say, adultery or other things to be treated in this specific way. They only interviewed in person, I think, two gay men. Most of the people were sort of things like scoutmasters and church elders and psychiatrists. And he was obviously very reluctant to speak to them. And Peter Wildblood, who was famously involved in the Lord Montague Bewley case and went to jail and then wrote this book called Against the Law, describing his experiences not only about the police illegally raiding his house without a warrant and not allowing him access to a solicitor, but also the way he was treated and how Wormwood Scrubs was run when he was in prison. And Wolfenden was very reluctant to speak to him. He thought, you know, this man's sort of protesting too much and, you know, we don't really want to hear from him. Let's hear from the director of the Fitzwilliam Museum instead, or Pat Trevor Roper, who was a very famous ophthalmic surgeon and GP to the great and the good. But I think, I mean, Wolfenden also went on later to do a report on sport, so he had a fairly wide brief. But, you know, he produced this report, which became a bestseller. And, I mean, there can't be many government reports that became bestsellers, I wouldn't have thought. But the Wolfenden report did. It sold out very, very quickly.
Peter and Philip, thank you both very much indeed for joining us.
And that's everything this week. As ever, if you've enjoyed the podcast, please do pick up a copy of the magazine. You can read everything we've talked about, plus plenty more. And if you like the podcast and are listening to us on Spotify or Apple, please click the follow button so you'll be notified when a new episode is out. I'm Laura Prendergast.
And I'm William Moore, and we do hope you'll join us again next week.